2. The journey of the exegesis from a chaos of paperwork stored after Dick's death in a garage in Sonoma, California, to this non-comprehensive publication is still, if not as unlikely as its creation in the first place, what could be a saga in itself. When Dick died in 1982, the exegesis was still a pile of papers in his apartment. Dick's friend, Paul Williams, then executor of his literary estate, sorted the fragments into the 91 file folders that still house it. Williams' provisional organizational choices, in the absence of other guides, remain evident in the form in which we present the material here. The exegesis spent the next several years in Williams' garage in Glen Ellen. It is difficult to overstate the degree to which Dick's reputation had gone underground in the 1970s and 1980s. It had never been very far overground to begin with, and his stature with publishers was non-existent. Working with Dick's agent, Russ Galen, Williams found remarkable success inventing Dick's posthumous career as we now know it, guiding the out-of-print novels into republication and a place in literary culture more secure than Dick probably ever imagined for himself. A number of unpublished novels, coherent, finished manuscripts, that in almost every case had already made the publisher's rounds and been rejected, were also brought to light. The exegesis, an unruly and unlikely manuscript that threatened to defy editorial ambition, remained terra incognita. Its first scholar, Jay Kinney, published a summary of the exegesis based on preliminary forays in 1984. Estimating the document at 2 million words, Kinney defined requirements for its publication: transcription from the handwritten pages, an attempt at chronological resequencing, and selecting out the most coherent portions. He rightly called this prospect staggering. With Williams and a few volunteers, Kinney's venture at least accomplished the photocopying and inventory of the 8,000-plus pages. At one point, a distributed transcription effort was begun by mail, swarm scholarship before the web. Kinney, in his article, also suggested that the published exegesis could be the basis for the founding of a Dickian religion, mentioning the name L. Ron Hubbard. His intent may have been flippant, but the notion seeped into the chatter and proved more hindrance than incentive to scrupulous investigation of the material. Next, biographer Lawrence Sutton edited 1991's In Search of Vallas, Selections from the Exegesis, a volume that thrilled and frustrated a core of seekers for whom the text was increasingly taking on the status of legend. Less than 300 pages long, In Search of Vallas presented an array of enigmatic morsels that, for some, only raised questions as to what might be in the other 7,700 pages. When Paul Williams relinquished his role as literary executor in the mid-1990s, the exegesis and other PKD manuscripts went into the custody of Dick's children. For them, the unpublished trove was fraught, since it attracted unwelcome attention and threatened to undermine their father's growing academic and literary reputation, with its disreputable aura of high weirdness. For some of Dick's admirers, even the novels written in the wake of the 2374 revelations are at best a footnote to what they regard as his seminal writings and, at worst, an embarrassment. An interesting exegesis subplot consists of Dick's reactions to meeting some of his earliest admirers in academia, whom he refers to as the Marxists, and who were clearly perplexed by his metaphysical preoccupations. "I proved to be an idiot savant," he writes, much to their disgust. The present editors have navigated this maze of perplexities in possession of a few useful axioms. One is that, putting aside any of the peculiarities earmarking his work or the circumstances of its creation, Philip K. Dick was one of the 20th century's great novelists. This makes the eventual public availability of his unpublished notes, journals, drafts, and other surviving papers not only desirable, but inevitable. This is as true of Dick's exegesis as it is of the notebooks of Dostoevsky or Henry James. If the fate of such material is to attract fewer readers than the writer's novels, and who would wish otherwise, It is nevertheless of clear importance that it emerge. Yet another axiom is this: the whole of the exegesis is unpublishable, short of a multiple-volume scholarly edition issued at a prohibitive price or, more likely, in an online form. Another belief we held going in: the exegesis is terrific reading, of a kind. We might say, if you take it for what it is, or if you care for this sort of thing. But those terms beg the question of what sort of thing it exactly is, and we are at a loss to answer that question. To give yourself to it completely, as Kinney and Sutton and ourselves, most especially the tireless Pamela, have done, demands a degree of mania and stupefaction we would not wish on another human, though we will undoubtedly not be the last. But to give yourself to it in part, at leisure, and in a spirit of curiosity, can be entrancing. And to become entranced by it is, contradicting ourselves now, to want more. One last axiom, then. In the compromises and sacrifices that this effort, by its nature, imposed, we will satisfy no one. We have set another foot on Everest, reached a slightly higher station than others before us, but not the summit. That admission leads to a declaration. This book spearheads an effort to transcribe, reorganize, or more rightly, organize, and eventually provide scholarly access to the entirety of the writing left behind by Philip K. Dick after his death. Much of what we excluded was repetitive and boring. Some was tantalizing but opaque or defied excerpt. But no one will need to take our word for this forever. 3. Determinist forces are wrong, though irresistibly strong. But of God there's a dearth, for he visits the earth, but not for sufficiently long. Or, determinist forces are wrong, though irresistibly strong, but of God there's no dearth, for he visits the earth, but just for sufficiently long. Science fiction writer Tim Powers recited these two limericks from memory, then explained. He'd call you up at 11 in the morning and say, "I just figured out some stuff. I just figured out the universe. Why don't you come over?" Possibly he'd written until 6 a.m., then slept from 6 to 11. I'd say, "I gotta go to work." "Write it down so you don't forget it." One day I said, "Oh yeah, and can you write it as a limerick?" When I showed up, he gave me two versions. In the last decade of his life, Philip K. Dick's friends and visitors became, one after the next, confidants of the iconoclastic human being who was both scribbling out the exegesis and, in many senses, living it. These eyewitnesses offer evocative accounts that amplify the text's human dimension, its tenderness, monologuing, obsessiveness, irascibility, seductiveness, despair, irony, voraciousness, curiosity, anger, and wit, and above all, its doubt and certainty, were Dick's own. Tim Powers continued, "Every day was starting again from zero. It was never cumulative, and every now and then he'd say, 'It's all nonsense, it's all acid flashbacks.' He'd be down, terribly depressed. For one thing, it would mean he'd wasted years. Then he'd be off again. He called me one day and said, 'Powers, my researches have led me to believe I have the power to forgive sins.' I said, 'Well, who have you forgiven?' He said, 'Nobody. I forgave the cat's sins and went to bed.'" Cartoonist Art Spiegelman, then a young fan who considered Dick the only living writer I wanted to meet, made his first visit to Dick's apartment in February 1974. It was 1 week before the vision. I planned a trip from SF to LA, but he wasn't answering his phone. We did our day at Disneyland. Then I thought, I can't not ring his doorbell. I stayed for 3 days. He was charming, eager for someone to talk to about his work. Only later did I find out he'd been in a deep funk. We'd talk, I'd fall asleep, he'd go in and begin typing, and then I'd wake up and we'd begin talking again. I think I have one of the earliest manifestations of what became the exegesis. I wish I could find it. we wanted a collaboration with Phil for Arcade Magazine. He gave us something sort of essay-like, clearly religious. It concerned taking Christopher to the hospital. This was the first clue I had that he was off in that territory, but I can't remember it being a very big deal in 74-75. He didn't seem obsessive, didn't seem manic. Later, visiting to recruit him for Raw Magazine, I thought, this guy's on the skids somehow. The apartment was the worst version of the Philip Marlowe housing complex. But he was studying Aramaic. I was struck, thinking, that's intense. There's not too many people doing that. Yet it didn't seem like a good influence on him. He seemed burdened by all this stuff. Crushed. I do remember expressing excitement about one idea, and he lit up. He'd figured out why evil exists on Earth. We were in a bubble, and God couldn't get to us. I liked that image, and we talked about it for a while. Painter and cartoonist Gary Panter offered a word portrait. Phil was pixie-ish and self-effacing, always ready to make himself the butt of the joke. He sat thinking with his head back and lips pursed a little. He smiled small before he smiled big. He had long fingers like a piano player's, white hairy chest peeking over his top button. His skin was pale. His lips were red. His cheeks had a tiny blush. He was like a clever fox, but tired, like he didn't sleep much. He told me more than once about the miracle of his intuiting his son's potentially fatal internal hernia. He'd take a big breath before he spoke because he knew the sentences would be long. His hands were lithe and expressive, often mirroring each other palm to palm. He had soulful, heartful eyes. With other people, he could have played other roles because he was a theatrical and prankish person. He laughed a lot. Tim Powers alludes to a notion found in other accounts as well, that in its later stages, the exegesis journey seemed to converge with a foreshadowing of its author's death. I do remember that around Christmas of 81, he was convinced that the world would end in a couple of months. And it did, for him. I thought, not bad. You were close. 4. Anyone interested in suggesting a medical, psychiatric, neurological, or pharmacological context for the experiences and behavior surrounding Philip K. Dick's exegesis, and by behavior, we mean, of course, and above all, the writing of the thing itself, will be spoiled for choice. Dick offers a wealth of indicators suggestive of bipolar disorder, neurological damage due to amphetamine abuse, a sequence of tiny strokes, it would be a stroke that killed him in 1982, and more. Within these pages, Dick mordantly speculates on a few himself. The decades since Dick's death have been fertile ones for popular neurological case histories, frequently of creative people, call it the Oliver Sacks era. It is likely that had Dick lived longer, he would have been drawn to project his own neurological metaphors for his visionary experiences. In particular, it is hard to imagine that his restless mind would not have been eager to explore what Eve LaPlante, in her 1988 article in the Atlantic Monthly, called The Riddle of TLE, Temporal Lobe Epilepsy. The cause of electrical seizures in the brain less dangerous and more diagnostically furtive than grand mal epilepsy. TLE is associated, in certain cases, with hypergraphia, superhuman bouts of writing, and hyperreligiosity, an unusual degree of concern with morality, philosophy, and mysticism, sometimes leading to multiple religious conversions, in LaPlante's words. Among the historical figures whose profiles are suggestive of a retroactive TLE diagnosis are Dostoevsky, St. Teresa of Avila, Emanuel Swedenborg, and Van Gogh. Temporal lobe epilepsy has, reasonably enough, drawn attention from Dick's biographers, and we should not hesitate to mention it here. Yet, given just a brief paraphrase of Dick's history, neurologist Alice Flaherty, author of The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and The Creative Brain, cautioned that one of any number of medical causes might easily account for Dick's hypergraphia. A TLE diagnosis is far from a foregone conclusion. Indeed, it is worth noting that Dick described hallucinatory experiences of one kind or another going back as far as grade school, that his earliest writings prefigure the ontological and moral concerns exhibited after 2374, and that his boggling literary productivity during his aspirant years and first ascendancy from 1952 to 1964 could easily be labeled hypergraphic. Dick's exegesis is a site, then, where we re-encounter one of the defining mysteries of our scientific age, the persistent elusiveness of a satisfying description of the full activities of mind, that is, consciousness, even as the mechanism of the biological brain yields itself increasingly to our understanding. 5. Dick's pursuit of the truth of 2374 was destined, like Zeno's arrow, for no destination. Years before his death, it became apparent that these activities would not cease until the pen fell from his hands, no matter his periodic attempts at closure. "Here ends 4 years and 6 months of analysis and research," Dick wrote. "Time is unmasked as irreal. 1900 years are disclosed as aspect of one underlying matrix. My 27 years of writing the same themes over and over again fits into place. 274 and 374 is comprehensible, as is the overthrow of Nixon. The transtemporal constants have been explicated. Perhaps I should destroy the exegesis. It is a journey that reached its goal." Dick wrote those words in 1978. They occur on the first page of an entry that would continue for 62 more. In the end, the exegesis can be viewed as a long experiment in mind regarding itself. The puzzle that Dick can never solve in this effort is that of his own exegetical efforts. This mind writes. Why? More and more, it may seem as if in describing the macrocosm, Dick describes the exegesis. The two are coextensive. Each falls victim to repetition and entropy. Each grows by reticulating and arborizing. Each, for its renewal, requires divine intervention in the form of language. The same questions apply to both. What saves the universe from running in useless circles until it drops? What separates the living spark of meaning from the inferior bulk of chaos and noise? Does the universe evolve or devolve? If the system is closed, then where does the new originate? We found ourselves struck by the notion that Philip K. Dick was, for all his garrulous explications, an aphoristic writer, in the vein of E.M. Choron or Blaise Pascal. What disguises his aphoristic gift is, simply, the scaffolding he left in place. Every impulse, every photon of thinking collects on the page. It is left for the listener to isolate the spires. What lies hiding within each object? A garden, so to speak. There are no gold prisons. The schizophrenic is a leap ahead that failed. To remember and to wake up are absolutely interchangeable. All that is colossal is fraud. The physical universe is plastic in the face of mind. Reality lacks discretionary power. What's got to be gotten over is the false idea that an hallucination is a private matter. One day the masks will come off, and you will understand all. It came to pass, and I was one of the masks. Each of these fine provocations is embedded somewhere in the exegesis's pages, together with more extensive sequences of aphoristic invention and self-contained parables too lengthy to quote here. We invite listeners to discover their own. Jonathan Lethem and Pamela Jackson. Editor's Note: Your humble scholars have wandered into a land that makes a mockery of scholarship. Dick's own centrifugal and chaotic methodology was more than infectious. It rewrote our attempts to rewrite it. This volume, then, reflects an enthusiastic foray on the listener's behalf. The larger purposes of archival scholarship could only have been answered with a completely transcribed and fully cross-referenced exegesis, a thing not bindable into the pages of a book. In the name not of apology, but of transparency, we offer an account of our compromises and the decisions that made them possible. We chose chronological ordering, yet this is a text that defies chronology. Dates were frequently determined only by internal clues or references, and so should be regarded as approximate and open to revision by future scholarship. We kept the folders intact, despite recognizing these as an artifact of Paul Williams' archiving rather than Dick's own ordering. The exegesis began in 1974 with letters and short pieces and grew steadily. The early pages form an epistolary detective novel, plunging the listener into the 2374 revelation. Dick began his interpretations even as clues in the form of dreams, voices, and visions poured in. Soon his letters grew longer and denser, some accompanied by enclosures of further typewritten notes. Short pieces with recognizable beginnings and ends gave way to the extended theoretical speculations and open-ended meditations that characterize the exegesis proper. By the end of this period, Dick was typing 20-plus pages at a go, single-spaced, with minimal margins in paragraphing. We have largely offered the earliest entries in full, as longer, more meandering entries begin in early 1975. We transition to the method of excerpting used for the remainder of the book, selecting discrete chunks of varying lengths from a single paragraph to several pages, with or without some internal trimming. Dick's text is given interpretive, personal, and unsystematic annotation by the editors and these others: Simon Critchley, Steve Erickson, David Gill, N. Catherine Hales, Jeff Kripal, and Gabriel McKee. These annotations are identified by their author's initials. Following the text and afterword by Richard Doyle, we offer an aid to the listener's comprehension, a series of individual notes on nomenclature, translation, sources, and editorial interventions. Let us be the first to say that the notes are incomplete. Nothing short of a vast, active, living intelligence could sort all of Dick's avenues of reference and citation. For one small example, among many, of the challenges in an annotator's path, Dick often quoted English sources from memory or altered sources as he hurriedly copied them out. His use of German and Latin is willful and imaginative. In consideration of sanity, our own, and time and space, which are, after all, the same thing, we have offered the gist of his intentions as we understood them, rather than unraveling his errors. A few names have been disguised to ensure the privacy of persons not wishing to be named.